Got it?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay.
Then along comes Pearl Harbor, World War II, U.S. involvement in World War II, and one of the first things that was happened by the government was to stop the manufacture of automobiles. Stopping the manufacture of automobiles stopped the demand for tetraethyl lead, so that we in the operations there were making tetraethyl lead were faced what to do, and what we did was to convert our facilities to making tetraethyl lead to making one of the synthetic rubbers, and we developed a process for making synthetic rubber in the tetraethyl lead equipment, and we just got to the point that we got a conversion. We're making along, and starting to make a synthetic rubber, and along comes Roosevelt and says we're going to build 50 million airplanes. Warplanes. And then, by damn hell broke loose. We had to get back into making tetraethyl lead.
How long were you involved with synthetic rubber before you moved back?
About a year and a half. Yeah.
And what was your function in that process?
I was in the organization. Tetraethyl lead organization. I was the head chemist or chief chemist or something, and we were just all given the job of converting to rubber manufacturer, and I was still there in the same position. Yeah.
You were actually involved in the manufacturing process.
Developing the manufacturing process, converting it. Actually, we were doing one of the thiokol rubbers, and we went and met with the thiokol people and got their process information, which we were trying to transmit to fit the kind of apparatus that we had and so forth. And,
yeah. Yeah, I noticed you have three patents on tetraethyl lead.
I have some patents there one patent I think was on purification, aeration or something like that. One patent may have been on the process, the improvement. This was a poster to try to improve the yield of tetraethyl lead. Similar.
Okay.
Similar.
Okay.
So just different means to try to improve the yield of conversion to tetraethyl lead. Yes.
Now, after not clear in my mind what you did after 1945.
After 1945, which is approaching the end of the war period, we had an organization upheaval in the tetraethyl lead groups, and the head man, the superintendent, and the second head man, the chief supervisor, were removed, and they went down and picked up Plunkett and said, "You're boss." And so I got promoted to being superintendent of the tetraethyl lead area in early 1945. And I had that position then until 1949, at which time I was transferred to a similar position and I was made the superintendent of the plant producing vat dyes.
Okay, the word ponsol.
Ponsol. Ponsol yeah. was a part of a trademark for vat dyes.
Okay, so that 45 to 49 period, I imagine the TEL became very important again because
TEL became, TEL became very important again, and it was a period up until then, DuPont and Ethyl Corporation were in manufacturing service agreement type of arrangements, and in that period of time we're talking about was. DuPont and Ethyl Corporation split, and DuPont went out to sell manufacture and sell on their own, and Ethyl Corporation went out to manufacture and sell on their own. And I was deeply involved in that schism, and the working out of the details of that schism, because we had the manufacturing plant there at Chambers Works, and the one that we were operating for Ethyl Corporation. Down at Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and hell, I spent half the time on the trains going back and forth to to Baton Rouge for several years. Yeah.
Now with the dyes, with the color area, that was.
I got transferred. I forget the exact period of time, but it was in the latter part of 1949. I got transferred into this dye operation as superintendent and got moved in there over top of everybody else was there, and I was a bad boy, resented. I only stayed there 9 months. 9 months later, in June of 1950, I got promoted to assistant plant manager of the Chambers Works. And all the resentment that I felt when I moved into that dye business was gone by that time.
Do you think that resentment was in part due to your association with Teflon, or was that?
I don't think Teflon. Was just at that point in time. It wasn't so clear that I was associated with the development of Teflon yet hadn't yet become too widely known.
I see.
Too widely known. The first public recognition that I received as inventor of Teflon was in 1951 when I was awarded the John Scott Medal by the City of Philadelphia. That was in 51, but I didn't receive it until June of 52, at which DuPont had set up a banquet and had a couple hundred people come to a banquet there at the Country Club in Pensgrove, New Jersey, and I was presented with the John Scott Medal, and had a big to do. Had Professor Allier from Princeton came down and talk about it, and he eulogized my work and so forth. So on. That was the first public recognition of many. And also, it was the first time that anybody in this country saw any cooking utensils lined with Teflon. Because what they did was to make up muffin tins lined with Teflon and give them out as favors to all the attendees to this banquet. And some of those muffin tins are still in existence.
Hmm.
I got one of them at home. Yeah,
and. How did the company, since we're talking about this was the first public recognition that you had, how did the company react it would must have taken a while before the full impact of what you had done.
Oh, I think it did. It did take quite a while. Of course, it didn't amount to anything financially to DuPont until probably 1950, maybe later. Because it was during these early stages, it was costing a hell of a lot more to produce it than they were getting for it, so that even though they were selling it for $25 a pound or something like that, and even though little gasket companies like the U.S. Gasket Company in Camden, New Jersey, had the Teflon delivered to the bank vault in a big bank there in Camden, and when they wanted to use some, they had to go to the bank to get a little bit.
I heard that story.
That's a true story. That's a true story. Absolute true story.
Before we look at what else you had done with DuPont, do you think the company eventually recognized you properly?
The company recognized me. There's no question in DuPont names. No question that Jefferson's mine is who's responsible for Teflon. I hadn't seen Ed for several years after I retired until down at Corpus Christi in 1983. That's 3 years ago. Which was the 10th anniversary of the startup of that plant. And Ed was down there going to give a talk. And I had seen him just shortly before the talk for us. And Ed took occasion to recognize me and eulogize me right there on the spot.
That's wonderful.
When I got notification that I had been nominated to receive the Inventors Hall of Fame recognition, I got a call from the senior vice president of the Central Research Department. He called me up and told me that Ed had asked him to call me. And then I got a day or two later. I got a letter from Ed. Calling about this. This was in early December, before Christmas anyhow, of 1984. In early January 1985, I had a call from Public Affairs Department, Lois was home. I was on the golf course. Somebody asked me where I was, and she said I was out on the golf course, and he said, well, ask him to call. I said, how would he like to have a vacation in Delaware? She says, what, in January? Well, I did go to January the next week. I did go to Wilmington January the next week and got up there. And they had been commissioned to see that I was properly recognized. And I came up there and spent a whole day talking to a bunch of people, and spent a day in a photo shop and things like that. And when it came up to time of the presentation of the honor, which they do down there, they have a banquet affair on Saturday night, and the presentation is actually on Sunday afternoon, so on. I was called to Wilmington several days ahead of this presentation, and they had the public relations outfit from Philadelphia to come and spend a day interviewing me, almost so forth, then I spent a lot more photography time. And then I went to Washington, and they had a public relations outfit down in Washington to set up interviews for me from from all of the TV, radio, newspaper, magazine that you got hold of. And I was in Washington from Friday until Tuesday evening, and I was constantly in a Mercedes limo being pushed from one place to the other. DuPont had a press breakfast on Tuesday morning following the presentation of the award, in which they invited a lot of people to come to a big press breakfast and had set up, and they had it in my honor, I had a big banner up, a new name in the Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. And they had several DuPont people, including the head man of the Central Research Department, and they had somebody from Bell Laboratories, the guy that's restoring the Statue of Liberty, the engineer in charge, and several others talk about there, and I got up and said a few words. Then Monday morning had appeared an article in the Washington Post, and it seems the White House saw this article in the Washington Post, and it told about I and some others, but this story was mainly about me. And it so happens the president was having a dinner luncheon on Tuesday of 100 scientists and engineers, and he said, "Hey, get these guys here." So I went to lunch with the president on on Tuesday. But on Sunday, after I got the award, first thing I did after having gotten the award practically was to get an airplane and fly to New York and appear on the Today Show on Monday morning and be interviewed by Jane Pauley and fly back to Washington before noon. So that I think...
Yes.
I think they recognize me.
I guess the reasoning behind that original question was the company itself, in terms of because the impact of the work took a while to be realize that.
Oh yeah. Well, it was no question about I was the guy, because if you get a list of the Teflon patents, it's the most widely patented patent the DuPont company ever had by far. And I was through the years I was being continually called up to sign a patent application. Every time it was patented in a new country, I had to sign an patent application, and there was no question that who made the discovery. No matter whether I was naive or anything else, whatever about it, there was no question that I made the discovery, and I knew what I had chemically. I didn't know all it was valued for and so forth, but I had made the discovery. As I said sometimes when I talk to high school kids, I've done that a number of times. And one of the things you go to school for is to learn how to think. And so you have to have a prepared mind when you get into a situation like this. And I think I had a prepared mind.
I'm intrigued by the fact that you worked very quickly on the properties and were able to determine exactly how unusual this material was. The next step then was to perfect the production of the polymer.
Was to demonstrate that I could make some.
Yes. And so then you had the way of doing it on a routine.
I had at least had a basis for a patent. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether I had a basis for routine. That was some of the other people got in to do that. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But I did immediately do something to try to find out what the hell it was. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What the hell it was about. Yeah.
Well, let's go back then to, I guess, 1953.
Let me come in here after the Manhattan District work got put the impetus to develop the processes for making and handling and fabricating Teflon. That work was successful. It found a lot of applications in military applications, and it found numerous applications in the chemical processes and connected with the Manhattan project. And one of the first military uses was a nose cone for the proximity fuses on proximity bombs. And because it was, it could transmit the radio waves so well, and that was one of the first uses. But it got a lot of uses, even in the early days there, in electric and electronic applications. And of course, those are the greatest uses today. The telecommunications field is the greatest single application of Teflon even today. Then, at the end of World War II, the patent secrecy was lifted, and in 1946, there was publications made and patents granted, and there were about 30 patents granted in 1946 related to Teflon materials.
Were these all DuPont patents?
I think that I'm talking only DuPont now. I don't know. I doubt it. I doubt it. There were because DuPont had apparently got some other people working at it by that time, and so the people and it's one of the things about it is there's been many chemists and engineers and entrepreneurs that have contributed to the development of Teflon and all of, and TFE, PTFE and all of its uses. But in 1946, the DuPont experimental station people put out a paper in ACS which they described some of the works done during World War II. And then the plastics department people put out a paper in Journal of American Engineering Chemistry, which they described the processing applications, and there had to be lots of inventions just to learn how to make how to handle the damn stuff, because one of the things was a ram extrusion press, in which you feed the powder into a bin, you know, and compress it into a heated zone and gun through the heated zone and come out with a rod or a tube or something and a processed Teflon under controlled conditions. And they come out with little rods to big tubes to create big batches of damn stuff. Obviously, it took an awful lot of work to develop that. And it made a lot of people.
Who were some of the people that worked in the area after you left it? You know, picked up where you left off.
Hanford and Joyce and Hanford, Hanford and Joyce, Joyce and Hanford, Butch Hanford, and Bob Joyce were two people that did work in the early 40s in the Central Research Department. And they published a paper in ACS in 1946.
And was their work mostly characterization?
Their work was process work to to how to methods of polymerization. They developed at least they developed the basis for the emulsion polymerization process, and they characterized the polymer. Did some early characterization work. And then in the plastics department was Malcolm Renfrew.
Oh, just talked to him yesterday.
You did?
Yes.
Malcolm Renfrew?
Yes, he's here.
He's here?
Yeah.
And Lewis, and I forget who the Lewis is now. They were both at Arlington at the time. They did a lot of work on. They did a lot of the work in connection with these developing techniques of handling the polymer.
I didn't realize Malcolm was involved.
Yeah.
What years would that have been?
Early 40s. Because the paper was published in 1946, which was after it was released after the war secrecy was lifted. And then, of course, the process for making TFE from pyrolysis of CHClF2, 22, pyrolysis of 22, that was developed and perfected by the people at Jackson Laboratory.
Nice.
Benning and McHarness, for instance.
Okay, all right. Yes. Their name appears on the...
On some patents, yeah.
Right. Did you keep up with what was going on with the Teflon while you were over in TEL?
I didn't keep up as much as I might have. I might have because I was not in on the secrecy of the Manhattan Project work.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I knew the Manhattan Project work was going on because we had the pilot plants right there on the Chambers Works, right next door. And I was aware that work was going, but I was not part of the thing. Although I was one of the first guys that got called after the bomb was dropped on by my associates 1945, yeah. I got a call from one of my bosses, I think it was. Said they just dropped a bomb on Hiroshima. Nagasaki. What? Nagasaki was first.
Hiroshima was first. Nagasaki.
Yes, right. Hiroshima was first. Yeah. Yeah. A couple other things I can say. A lot of engineers and so forth come on to, I'm going to have a couple of paragraphs to say about from stovetops to space, outer space, from electronics to ecology, from architecture to Statues of Liberty, from this and this to all things that come, that Teflon touches every one of us some way almost every day, and it is an integral part of all of the things that make the machinery of commerce work today. And that's there. And then I want to add up one thing more. I add up at the end. It's been exciting to have been a part of this thing. I had a part in it, and it's to know that it's been a benefit to real people, not just imaginary people, but real people that I know. And I tell that some years ago, I attended a dance near Wilmington, and a doctor friend of mine says, "Hey, Roy, I want you to meet somebody here." He says, "See this gentleman out here who's dancing today?" He said, "He's here dancing only because he's wearing a Teflon aorta, which I installed."
Mm.
So I add to that. That I, over the years, I've experienced and heard of many instances like that, and it makes me realize that I have been more than just helpful.
Absolutely.